Okay, welcome. Ezra, week 14. We are up to Parakeh. We're up to chapter 5. Last week we cleared out the rest of chapter 4. So, quick summary. Again, in chapter 1, Cyrus, also known as Cyrus the Second, also known as Cyrus the Great, has conquered Babylon in the name of the Persian Empire. He permits the Jews to return and to build the Beis HaMikdash, to build the temple. Chapter 2, we're told about the Jews who returned. We are given a census of the Jews of Babylon, meaning Babylon the city, who return, led by Sheshbatzar and then Zerubbabel, as well as Yoshua Kohen Gadol. We're told that, all told, there are 42,000, although the census is not of the entire 42,000. We're given the different lineages, as we discussed. Then in chapter 3, we saw the returnees first scattered to their cities, presumably setting up homes, planting fields. But then they come to Jerusalem for the month of Tishrei. They band together to build an altar, to bring offerings, to celebrate Sukkot. And then they start building a Beis HaMikdash. They start building a temple. And we noted that that section that appears in chapter 3 may also appear in Nehemiah. There's a passage in Nehemiah that speaks of a building going on in the seventh month, the month of Tishrei, that may refer to this. It may not. And then in chapter 4, the Samaritans, seeing that we have begun to build, come to us and say, hey, let's build with you. Let's build a temple. The Jews refuse, whether because the Samaritans are insincere and the feeling is they're going to try to stop the construction, or because of the fact that the Samaritans trace themselves to people who were originally idolatrous when they were moved into the northern area by the Assyrians, and they retained their idolatry even as they also adopted some Jewish practices. And so there is a fear that they want to use this for their God. And so they retaliate by preventing us from building. And we're told that they try two different tactics. One is intimidation, and the other is lobbying the Persians. And we're told that that lobbying goes on for an extended period of time. And then we're given a particular story of lobbying. And that was what we had covered last week. A story which either is in chronological order, and it's an attempt by the Samaritans to halt the construction of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple itself, by writing away to the Persians and saying, you don't want to let these Jews build their temple. If you let the Jews build the temple, the next thing you know, they're going to stop paying taxes, and they're going to revolt, because that's what Jews do. That was one approach. The other approach is that this is just an example of the types of things they did, drawn from later in history when we're building the walls of Jerusalem. And again, they write away to the Persians. The story itself is the same. They write away to the Persians saying, these Jews will stop paying taxes, they're going to revolt, because that's what Jews do. And the government says, ha, we looked at our records, and sure enough, that's what Jews do. So therefore, until further notice, there's to be no construction. So whether that event from chapter 4 was part of the building of the temple, or a later story about the building of the walls of Jerusalem, doesn't change things for us in terms of where we are now, because either way, at the start of chapter 5, the Jews have stopped building the temple. Whether we have stopped because of that story, meaning they wrote away to the Persian said, stop, or whether we stop because of the intimidation, which has been described in the text. As chapter 5 begins, we are not building the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, and in fact the construction stops until, as we said at the end last time, the second year of King Darius. So we've gone through the time of Cyrus, through the time of Cambyses II, who we don't get discussed in Tanakh, and now we're at the time of King Darius, who, according to some, is the son of the union of Esther and Ahasuerus. Right? There's, again, as I noted, there's an Ibn Ezra that seems to say he is Ahasuerus, but generally speaking, the more popular idea is that he's the son of Esther and Ahasuerus, and that's where we're going to pick up with chapters 5 and 6, and attempt to start the building once again. All right.
Just a quick question.
Yeah, that was the group that I described way back when, when we started this discussion of chapter 4, the group that the Assyrians moved in. Remember we said the Assyrians brought a whole bunch of different nations, and their capital is in Shomron, Samaria, hence the name Samaritan.
Yeah.
No, Semitic is different. Semitic comes from Shem.
Good Samaritans.
Oh, yeah, that's a Christian thing. I'm not responsible for that. I had a teacher when I was in grade school who said that, you know, he didn't teach us about the story about the Shomronim. He just told us, yeah, Samaritans are bad, and the Christians have this idea of a good Samaritan because there was a text that said, and there was a good Samaritan, and it was such a surprise, and it said, oh, there's a good Samaritan. I have no idea if this reflects anything. I think I once went looking for any source for what he had said, but I didn't find. But in any case, that's their thing. That's not one of ours. Generally speaking, we don't have the words good and Samaritan go together in Tanakh. Okay, so let's take a look just on the sheets. I gave you the outline of where things are going here in chapters 5 and 6. 5 is going to begin with, as we already noted at the very end last time, a renewed charge to build to build what seems to be the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. It seems fairly clear we're talking construction of the temple here, not of the walls of Jerusalem. Then we'll get to the governor's challenge. The governor is a gentleman by the name of Tatnai, and we're going to talk about him. Tatnai says, excuse me, but where are your papers? Where is your zoning work? Who authorized this? He writes away a letter to King Darius, saying, you know, these Jews are building and I don't really know what to do. The Persian archives are searched, and lo and behold, they find the record of the license to build. The license we will see there will not match what we saw in chapter 1, which we'll have to discuss when we get to it. Darius is going to say, okay, go ahead, go build. And at that point, the temple will be built, it will be dedicated, they'll celebrate Pesach, and God willing, we will get through that before Pesach. So you'll have nice Divrei Torah for your Seder. You can talk about the Pesach the Jews celebrated in the days of King Darius. Okay, but in order to do this, we have to talk about this fellow Tatnai, the governor, or as he is termed in the Aramaic, the Pecha. Pecha, a term like Pasha. It means the person who is in charge. And I brought you on your sheet in source number 2, a piece from Professor Mordechai Zerkavo, the editor of the edition of the volume of Ezra in the Dat Mikra edition of Tanakh, in which he writes, Mitoch harishyonot hanimtzeim b'sefer Ezra, based on the documents that we find in Ezra, Yotze shel Yehuda haita autonomia. If you want to know how to write autonomy in Hebrew, autonomia. Autonomia datit umishpatit rechava. He says it appears that Judea had a very broad religious and civil autonomy. From the time of Cyrus all the way through the early years of Darius, mashluba nesiim mizera David, the leaders were princes from the house of David, Sheshbatzar and Zerubbabel, ve'imahem ziknei Yehuda, and presumably the elders of Judea with them. The other people we've mentioned, like in when we listed who came back, and we had all these other people with them, that's their council of sorts. In Bitul Shilton Tzatzai Batei HaMalachim, however, with the cessation of the rule of the descendants of the royal houses, meaning the house of David, Sheshaltu Barzosehem Bitam Malchus Paras, who reigned in their land with authorization by the Persians, be made Daryavesh. And this happened, this cessation happened in the times of Darius, with that halting. At that point, authority is taken from the house of David and given to the Pecha. He does not say what causes the end of that line. Is it that Sheshbatzar and Zerubbabel don't have kids? Is it that the Persian government decides enough of these descendants of the house of David? Is it that they had kids, but the kids weren't worthy? The nation didn't want them? We don't get any information to explain how it is that suddenly Tatnai is in charge. We are introduced to him in the beginning of chapter 5 as the person who is in charge and acknowledged by the Jews as well. Yeah, David.
Could it be connected with the previous situation? That is to say, you don't want the temple to be built, you don't want the walls to be built, you don't want the royal house to rule, because all of this could lead to rebellion.
Right.
So in place,
it's possible. It's possible, but it would be strange. And I say it would be strange for two reasons. David is suggesting that maybe they were actively deposed. Like the Persian government said, discovering these records of rebellion by the Jews, it's probably best that they not be ruled by themselves. They not have this autonomia. I like the word. The weakness of it is, number one, if that had happened, I would have expected it to be recorded in the book. At the least, in the letter that they send back from Persia, they should have said, and by the way, take away control from Zerubbabel. Yeah, I would have thought that would be there. The other is that when the Jews are going to correspond with the Persians, they're going to mention Zerubbabel as though the name should mean something to them. As, you know, they're going to talk about that as, oh, well, this is our authority for building. As though it's a positive. And if the Persians had deposed him because they were concerned about rebellion, I'm not so sure he would be the one I would... Right. You know, I don't know, though. It's an interesting suggestion. I think that it has certain problems. And as I said, the text isn't going to give us any information at all about what triggers the switch. But what we do find at this stage is that they're ruled by a pecha. And what we know from documents in the Persian Empire is that the job of the pecha is basically twofold. Collect taxes for the empire and make sure the citizens aren't hurting each other. That's more or less the role of the pecha. And he answers to somebody whose name or whose title will be familiar to readers of Megillat Esther, the Achashdarpan. If you remember Megillat Esther, you have the Achashdarpanim, which you read and you think, well, I don't know what that means. I guess the translation is Achashdarpan. And the answer is, this was a functionary who ruled over a broader area, and in each subspace, think of like mayors and governors or something along those lines, in each subspace you have a pecha who ultimately has to report to the Achashdarpan. And the empire itself is broken up into Achashdarpanim, regions which are led, each one by an Achashdarpan. The Persians like their syllables. Interestingly, Encyclopedia Mikra'it notes that Tatnai himself is actually testified to in contemporary documents. I mean, he isn't only known to us from the Book of Ezra. He was Pecha for this area, which is called Eber HaNahar, west of the Jordan. Right? And the reason why it's identified by that name is because if you're writing from a Persian perspective, right? The Persians are off to the east. So this is the area between the Jordan and the Mediterranean. It's the west of the other side of the river. And he reported to a man whose name may be pronounced Ushtani. He would be the Achashdarpan, who was in charge of Bavel and Eber HaNahar. Bavel not being the empire, Bavel being the city. Tatnai himself comes across as a very by-the-book, law-and-order type of a governor. He doesn't take every step against us that he could. And when the construction is ordered, because, spoiler alert, Darius is going to say, keep on building, he complies immediately. He doesn't start trouble. He doesn't look to stall. At the same time, we find sources that don't like him. If you take a look at source number 3, Medrash and Shir HaShirim Rabbah, there's a verse, a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, in what I think of as the center of the book, where the Jews are described as the beloved of God who didn't answer when God knocked at the door, and then they go out looking, where is God? Then we're told, Mitzauni hashomerim hasavavim ba'ir hikuni pitzauni. The guards who were circulating, patrolling the city, found me, and they struck me and they injured me. So on that, the Medrash says in number 3, Mitzuni Hashomrim HaSovim Ba'ir, the guards patrolling the city found me, Zet Tatnai Pachas Eber Naharav HaChaverav. This is Tatnai, the Pecha of the other side of the river, and his allies. So they put him in a hostile sense. The guards are not nice people who are doing their job. The guards are hostile people. And that's something that we're going to have to come back to in the chapter itself. As we read what happens with him, we'll have to ask ourselves, is Tatnai just a functionary who's in the wrong place at the wrong time? Or is he like the Samaritan, somebody who doesn't like us and is trying to give us a hard time because he doesn't like us? So we begin, again, with the beginning of the chapter itself. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, you want page 1823. Chapter 5, sentence 1. We already noted this at the end last time. We'll read the first couple of psukim, the first couple of sentences. V'his nabi chagai neviya, uzchariah var'ido neviyaya, Al Yehudaye, Al Yehudaye, sorry, Divi Yehuda Yerushalayim, Bishum Eloka Yisrael Aleihon. So Haggai the prophet and Zechariah Bar Ido, the prophets, prophesied upon Yehuda, Judea, which was in Yehuda and Yerushalayim, in the name of the God of Israel. And this is what he said for them. And I noted this already last time, that that if you look in the beginning of Haggai, you will find indeed that all, actually not just the beginning, all of Haggai's prophecies that are recorded in the book of Haggai occur in the second year of King Darius. And that's his central message to the Jews, is get up and build. That's Haggai. And then you have Zechariah. Zechariah is assumed to be younger than Haggai, because whenever he's listed, he's always listed after Haggai. He's always Haggai and Zechariah. He may be actually the same Kohen as Zechariah who we're going to see in Nehemiah. He's going to get named over there as the head of a family of Kohanim. We see that that he's called Zechariah Bar Ido here. Ido is assumed by Radak and others to actually be his grandfather, and that he was a prophet as well, because we have Midrashim that mention an Ido Hanavi. So Ido the prophet. So Zechariah, we have a prophecy of Zechariah in the beginning of his book with an announcement that God has had mercy on Yerushalayim, and that is also dated in the second year of King Darius. So Haggai and Zechariah in the second year of Darius, as recorded in their own books, tell us that it is time for us to build. Just to give you a frame of reference historically, assuming this is Darius the First, right? Because we did have one possibility when we went through all our chronologies to say this would be Darius the Second. But pretty much everybody else thinks this is Darius the First. So the historians will say that Darius the First is the year 520 before the Common Era. That's the that's when he starts, and that's going to matter when we see Tatnai's reaction. So keep in mind, remember the year 520 before the Common Era. It is a year that matters. However, it's a year that matters to us for a different reason. With all this emphasis on the second year of King Darius, we have to understand why the second year of King Darius should be a special year for us. Forget the rest of the world, but why is the second year of King Darius a special year for us? So here, Malbim is going to take us on a dive back into something that I really ducked until now, because it's confusing. But Malbim lays it out, and if you like Malbim's approach, you won't be confused at all. If you want to try to compare it to the approaches of others, your mileage may vary. But Malbim lays it out very clearly, and that is the question of the famous 70 years. In our first weeks of looking at Ezra, we noted that Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, had prophesied that in 70 years we would come back. However, as Malbim notes, there are actually two prophecies. One prophecy says, in 70 years Babylon will fall. The other one says, that after 70 years we will come back. And what Malbim says is that the two are not one and the same. Take a look at source number 4. And you'll see what I mean. And in this, he's also going to address certain questions. He doesn't mention the questions, but you'll understand from what he's saying what the question is. He says, Nuvoas Yirmiyah Haisamafureshes, Shetia Pakuda Be'ez Chorban Bavel. Jeremiah's prophecy was explicit that our recalling by God, the Pikuda, when God would remember us and take care of us, that would be when Babel would be destroyed. Which would be after Babylon had been a leading empire for 70 years. And he gives you references to Psukim in Yirmiyahu, which you can look up to see it. Amnam, lefiha onesh shenen shulios begalos shivim shana bavur bitul hashmitos. However, based on the punishment we were given, which was to be in exile for 70 years because we had failed to fulfill Shemitah. I'm going to pause here to explain what in the world he's talking about. Shemitah is the sabbatical year during which you're supposed to leave the land fallow. It occurs every 7 years. So, based on a count of the years before the destruction of the temple, the conclusion is that we had missed 70 Shemitah years. And therefore there had to be 70 years when the land would rest, meaning we wouldn't be there to farm it. How you get to the 70 is a lot of fun, but not for right now. The Gemara in Erechim will give you a run for your money on that one. But the point is, he's saying, it isn't enough to go 70 years for the Babylonian Empire. We have to be in exile for 70 years. We're not exiled by Nebuchadnezzar in the beginning of his reign. We know you have 18 years before we actually get thrown out. Right? He comes through three times. So that's his point here. He says, based on that, we're in the middle of the second line in the Hebrew. In the English, we are, the count should have begun. If you're going to go based on the 70 years that we should be in exile, then you should start from when King Tzidkiyahu, the last king we had of the first temple, when he goes into exile. And he says, "Ushneim niskaimu." So the answer is yes, both were fulfilled. Both 70-year counts are fulfilled, and this is the way it works. Shalim los devar Hashem b'fi Yirmiya, heir Hashem esruach koresh b'shnas achas lemalcho v'nasan pekudash yeshuvu liushalayim v'yivdu amikdash. He says, fulfilling the prophecy of Yirmiyahu, God awakens Cyrus in the first year of his reign, meaning the first year of his reign over the Babylonians, as we discussed, the year 539 before the Common Era, according to the historical count. And at that point, he says, go back to Yerushalayim and build the Beis HaMikdash. V'hayarak pekuda limlos lemalos masha amar Yirmiyahu v'shevim los shivim shana shalbavel, etc. The goal was to fulfill the prediction that after 70 years of Babylon, then we would come back. V'lo ya'ad sham she'ivna mikdash az, or she'ivna mikdash az, she'ze lo haya zmano ata. But that's not a fulfillment, that's not a prediction that the temple will be rebuilt at that point. Rak yudches shana achar ze, lo shivim shana l'churvas Yerushalayim. It's only 18 years later, 7 years after Jerusalem has been destroyed, she'az Yigomer mechapra, I suppose, or yeah, mechapra is the best I can do with that word. Vavon hashmitos is at that point, that's when there is atonement for the sin of shmita non-observance. Rakshim lo hayano sein mishayon livnos hamikdash lo yishavim in hagola. I'm going to explain the rest of this outside because I think it needs explanation outside. You can follow it though inside. Here's the deal. He's trying to answer two different questions. Question number one that he's trying to answer is, I'm confused as to how the 70 years are supposed to work. Because if the 70 years really ended when Cyrus brought us back, right, when Cyrus sent us home, then we should have had a temple at that point. Right? That's what ought to have happened. The Samaritans should not have been able to stop us. That should have been it. We should have come back, we should have built the temple, and none of this business with the Samaritans stopping us and writing letters to Darius, none of that should have been part of the conversation. So that's question number one that he has to deal with, is what happened to the construction. Question number two is, which 70 years are we talking about, and how do they play out in the chronology of the kings? So what he's trying to present us with is the idea that there are actually two separate things that have to happen. One, we will be under the Babylonians for 70 years. Two, the temple will be in ruins for 70 years. And those two things are not the same. So he says, 70 years after the Babylonian Empire is... rises, if you will, under Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus allows us to return home. That's also the year when Cyrus conquers Babylon. Separate from that, 70 years after the temple is destroyed, we will have a temple. And that's what happens after all the letters back and forth with Darius. There's an 18-year gap in between, according to Malbim's chronology. You follow that? So he addresses the question then, there's only one remaining question, which is, then why did Cyrus order the construction of the temple? Cyrus should have just sent us home. Why is there any discussion about building the temple at all in chapter 1? So you could say, well, Cyrus has free will, he decided we should build a temple. But he says that's part of the plan. He says, if the Jews had been told you're coming back to the... That's the part I didn't read out loud here. If the Jews had been told they were coming back to the land, Cyrus says, you can go home, but you can't build a temple... They wouldn't have gone at all. They would have said, that's not the redemption we're looking for. We're not going to be anything there. We're going to suffer there. We could suffer here. Why should we come back? And therefore, Cyrus says, you can come home. They think they're going to build the temple, but actually, they have another 18 years to go. And before that can happen. That's the way Malbim reads the story. So the upshot of this, and the reason why I'm walking you through this, is because, repeating here, it's the second year of Darius, and seeing it in Haggai, it's the second year of Darius, and seeing it in Zechariah, it's the second year of Darius, is not because we love Darius' second year. The point is, this is something that has been promised for generations. We've been waiting for this point 70 years from what happened earlier. That's the idea. Now, the one weakness with all of this, I know at least some of you are wondering, I see it on a couple of faces, then why didn't the text say so? Right? Why did it say, if this is the fulfillment, just like you can have Yirmiyahu say, in 70 years you're coming back, you could have had a verse here that said, and now after 70 years they were home. And it doesn't. And all I can do is shrug. I don't know. I don't understand why it's not why it's not written here explicitly.
That's not the only thing.
Sorry?
That's not the only thing that we've learned that wasn't written.
No, but if that's such an important thing, right? I mean, it's the confirmation of a major prophecy, right? You know, perhaps the major prophecy of the time, and when you think about it, the idea that your exile has a pre-planned end, and look, here it happened. Yeah, I would have wanted to see it in the book. I don't know why it's not there. Shana, help me out.
I don't know if it's real, but I know that the very first verse of Ezra refers to Lichlot Bar Hashem b'Yirmiyahu.
Right.
When Jeremiah's word from the mouth of God was brought to a conclusion.
Yes, but that only makes things worse.
Oh.
You alluded to it there, but now here is the actual end. Why are you telling me it's the second year of King Darius? I don't care about King Darius. All right, fine. If he's Esther's son, I care about him somewhat. But I don't know. Bothers me. Okay. So Zerubbabel and Yeshua Kohen Gadol hear this charge, going back into the text. Pasuk Bet, sentence 2. Beidayin, at that point, Kamu Zerubbabel bar Shaltiel v'Yeshua bar Yotzadak v'it. At that point, Zerubbabel and Yehoshua Kohen Gadol begin to build the house of God in Yerushalayim. And among them were prophets of God who helped them. Prophets of God may refer to Haggai and Zechariah, could refer to unnamed others, although it's strange, but it wouldn't be the first time. We have unnamed prophets elsewhere in Tanakh. Sefer Shoftim has them, so they could be here too. Okay. But now we get into the story proper. The governor's challenge. We're going to start with Psukim. We'll start with Psukim Gimel Tehei. Sentences 3 to 5 as our first chunk of this. Bezimna asa layon tatnai pachas avar nahara ushisar boznai uchnavas hon. At that point, Tatnai, the pacha of this area on the other side of the river, the Jordan, as well as Shtar Boznai and their friends. I don't know if this is Ushtar as an and Shtar, or if the U is actually part of his name. I'm inclined to think it's an and Shtar. Is that how when they translate it, they render his name as Shtar?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, they actually have it as one word, Shtar Boznai. Okay. Well, that makes sense, because it was hyphenated because his mother kept her name. Yeah.
Why not?
That makes sense, just because there's a conjunction before Shtar, and there isn't before Boznai, so it makes sense to think that it's one name. Okay. And Shtar Boznai and their friends, they came to the site of the construction. V'chein Amrin Lahom, and this is what they said to them. Manasam Lahom Te'em Baisa Dina Livnei. Who exactly gave the order for this house to be built? V'usharna dina l'shachlala. And to strengthen this usharna, as we said already in the previous chapter, either refers to walls or refers to foundations. So, you know, where is your license? Where are your papers? What in the world do you think you're doing? V'ein ela kahom havas al shah. I'm sorry, I jumped. Edayin k'nei ma'amar nolahom. So, at this point, as is said, we told them. And what it means is, as is going to be said further on here. So rather than say everything twice, it just says, as the chapter is going to outline, that's what we, the builders, told them. What are the names of the people who are building? Who is in charge of this construction? However, the eye of God was upon the returnees to Judea. And Tatnayan crew did not stop them from building before the order would come back from Darius. He said, you can go right on building. Just, you know, when Darius sends a letter home, you might have to take everything apart. And then the letter would come back telling them what's supposed to happen. So just pausing with this, what's your impression of Tatnai? In these few verses?
I think it was pretty good. He didn't, like the city of Toronto will come and say, stop.
Right. No, he didn't say stop. He didn't say your construction is over until, you know, further notice. True. On the other hand, yeah, David.
Do we know if he's Persian or local?
He seems to be Persian. Yeah. He seems to be Persian, part of the hierarchy. He's the Pecha, right? Like I said in the beginning.
Yeah,
that seems to be
local.
Right.
According to Persian or Persian descent.
Right, understood. My impression is Persian, but I'm not even sure why I'm so sure. Yeah. Probably to somebody who has a better knowledge of Persian names than I do. Yes.
But there's a God intervention.
Yeah.
Who he is really doesn't matter. He's a monster or he's benevolent. God intervention.
And that's the other way you can look at it. It isn't necessarily that he's a nice guy. It's Ein Elokahom Aleihom, right? Their God is looking out for them, and therefore they're able to keep building. It's really not clear.
Do we know who the people are that come with him?
No. Shtar Boznai?
Yeah.
No, we get nothing about him anywhere. Even Tatanai, there's nothing about. I went hunting to see what else I could dig up, and they're really like, no one's interested in talking about Tatanai. It's kind of depressing. I mean, he made it into
Tanakh. Well, he is the first Pacha who suddenly, after 18 years, is the first one who injects himself into the process.
Well, we hadn't been doing anything. We weren't building. We just started building, and he said, wait, who entitled you to do that? They were very happy when we were doing nothing. Yeah, Debbie, you were going to say?
I just wondered, why does it matter what his character is?
Oh, I think it matters a great deal.
It does matter, but I don't quite understand.
Let me first take Helen's question and then come back to yours. Yeah.
He wouldn't be mentioned if there wasn't something important to that.
Well, we're very detail oriented in this book. We have a lot of names here. You know, we it's true that some people are being omitted, some people are just and their friends, but we get an awful lot of names for both. Yeah, I think I'm going to go back to Debbie's question. Why does it matter whether Tatnai is a good guy or not? No, but what does it matter to us as the reader? I don't understand. What do you mean by he has a lot of power?
To impact on the building.
Right.
He could stall it. He might be able to facilitate it.
Okay.
Or their life. I mean.
Okay, so as a cog in this story, he's going to matter. Okay. Oshava.
What do you think? Like, is it a roadblock that he's putting up, or is this like just more information, but then to open up the road? Like, you're just not sure yet. Like, is he going to interfere, or is he going to open up?
Right. So I think it matters because of a more fundamental question than when we approach Torah, and frankly when we approach our own day. Is everybody who opposes us, or is everybody who opposes what we think of as the divine plan, a bad guy? Are there people who just, you know, aren't on our side, so to speak? They're not doing what we want them to do, but it doesn't mean that he's a villain. He's just, you know, he has his job to do. He's been assigned to make sure that everything is on the up and up. The Jews are building. He knows of nothing that's been filed for this. And so he's going to show up, you know, when the shul wants to open and the fire marshal comes in and says, well, you're not up to code. Is he a wicked person, or is he just the fire marshal doing his job and frankly saving lives?
Like, functionary is what you're saying.
Yeah. I don't know. But I think that I think you could read the story both ways. And the story is read both ways in the commentaries. Take a look, please, at number 5. Well, he's not just asking questions. He's also sending letters.
Did this happen in reaction to the letter that was sent?
No, the letter seems to be ancient history to them. The letter seems to not be an issue for them. The
God instructs, God orders from the head of the corporation that you have to.
Let me ask you a question. Does anybody here have an Ezra in front of them with Rashi in it? All right. That's all right. No, the reason I ask is because I'm about to show you source number 5, and I wrote Ibn Ezra on it on here, and in my notes I wrote Rashi. So I want to know who's right. Do you think they have an Ezra with Rashi? All right, if you could, thank you. That would be helpful. Ibn Ezra paints him as a bad guy. Take a look at number 5, please.
Wasn't the last standing order not to build?
Yes. So I'm coming back to that. Hang in there. Amru lahem li Yisrael osana tzare Yehuda u'binyamin. The ones who said this to Israel were the enemies of Yehuda and Binyamin. In other words, he's a bad guy. He's with the Samaritans. He's part of that contingent, according to what is it, either Rashi or Ibn Ezra. But then flip the page, and you see Malbim. Malbim says, thank God, literally, that it was Tatnai. He says, Zaya Bashkachas Hashem, this was divine supervision. Shalobo Aleim Tsarehem, that their enemies did not attack. What does he say? What does
he want to know what? It's so dark, and I figured bring it to you.
All right, thank you. Let's see. No, it is, it's not Rashi, so it must be. Hang on. Oh, there's, I love the fine print. No, you know what? It's weird to see the way they structured it, but I believe that the way it's structured here is that it's Rashi. It's Rashi. It's a mistake on my sheet. It should say Rashi. So it's Rashi number 5 who says that he's with the enemy, that Tatnai is on the bad team. But then Malbim in number 6 says, Zaya Bashkachas Hashem Shalom Bo Aleim Tsarehem. It's divine supervision that makes it that that Tatnai is the one who comes instead of the enemies. Shehema Yumachrim Osem Biyad Chazakah. They would have done it with a mighty hand. They would have disturbed. Kamo B'Pam Arishon, like the first time we read about. Ukmo Shiratu Achar Kachli Lachem Itam Al Binyan HaChoma. And as the Samaritans would try to go to war with us when we're building the walls. Rak Shabbat Tatnai Pachas Eber HaNahar Vahu Lo Yatzur HaYehudim. Along comes Tatnai, who's no enemy of the Jews. He asks, who gave you the permission for this? Because at that time, they've already forgotten about Cyrus's permission. That's ancient history to them. So therefore, he asks this this question. So there are two legitimate ways to look at Tatnai, and depending on which way you look at him, that will determine how you explain when it says that this was divine intervention. Right? Either the divine intervention that's there is that the fact that it's Tatnai, right, and not the enemies of Yehuda and Binyamin, or the help from God is that even though these were the enemies, nonetheless, they're not prevented from building. So there are two different ways, legitimately, that you can read it, but I think it's a fascinating question because there is, I think, within our community, a tendency to just assume that if someone does something we don't like, they are the enemy. Not necessarily. Sometimes it's just someone who's, you know, a well-meaning person who happens to have an agenda that's different from ours. And to me, that's what's going on, you know, per Malbim. David?
Is it possible that the two people accompanying Tatnai are Samaritans in the sense that they're the ones who come to the governor and say, look, they start building again. You've got to do something about this.
Entirely possible. We just have no reason to say so.
And it still makes him sort of a part character. But he's investigating something that's brought by the evil Samaritan.
Right. I mean, we could theorize, but I don't know.
Do the names mean anything?
Not that I know of, no. Not that I know of. But there's another piece to this, and this goes back to my point about the year 520 before the Common Era. Those of you who were here when we did Eov will recall, maybe, all right, fine. It was in our first year that we did Eov. We had Eov for 2 years. At one point, Eov speaks of inscribing his story, Be'et Barzel, with an iron, literally iron pen, you know, with some kind of a stylus on stone. Right, when he talks about being remembered, if he's going to die, at least his story should live on after him. And we noted at the time that that Mikra edition said this may place the writing of the story in the beginning of the Second Temple, because we know that King Darius recorded his story on stone for everybody to read as they walked past, which is the same phrase that's used in Eov. And we noted at the time that this is something called the Behistun, the inscription. So that now comes back to haunt us. If you take a look at source number 7, lines 18 to 21 of this Behistun inscription, Darius describes certain wars on which he embarked. King Darius says, "Then I marched against that Nedintu Baal who called himself Nebuchadnezzar." This is not the original Nebuchadnezzar. This is Nebuchadnezzar IV. For those keeping score. "The army of Nedintu Baal held the Tigris. There it took its stand, and on account of the waters, the river was unfordable. Thereupon, I supported my army on inflated skins. Others I made dromedary-borne. For the rest, I brought horses. Ahura Mazda," right, the Persian god this in this Zoroastrian system, "brought me help. By the grace of Ahura Mazda, we crossed the Tigris. Then did I utterly overthrow that host of Nedintu Baal on the 26th day of the month." I don't know how to pronounce that. But it's the 13th of December, they decided, 522 before the Common Era. We joined battle. So he's doing some kind of battle against Babylonians 17 years after the Babylonians have been crushed. In other words, this is a Babylonian revolt. King Darius says in the next line, "After that I marched against Babylon, the city itself, but before I reached Babylon, that Nedintu Baal, who called himself Nebuchadnezzar, came with a host and offered battle at a city called," I'm guessing Zazana, but I don't actually know, "on the Euphrates. Then we joined battle. Ahura Mazda brought me help. By the grace of Ahura Mazda did I utterly overthrow the host of Nedintu Baal. The enemy fled into the water. The water carried them away. On the second day of the month, Anamaka, 18th of December, 522, we joined battle." Next line. King Darius says, "Then did Nedintu Baal flee with a few horsemen into Babylon. Thereupon I marched to Babylon," and so on. He takes Babylon, captures Nedintu Baal, slays him. "And then, while I was in Babylon, these provinces revolted from me. Persia, Elam, Media, Assyria, Egypt, Parthia, Margiana." He's got problems. No wonder he set up a Petha system, right? All these different empires or provinces rebel against him. What does that tell us about our story?
Including Persia.
Yeah, he's got an issue in Persia itself. Well, no, what do you see? Oh, you mean the first one, yeah.
But there's a real problem in the greater empire.
Yeah, there's a problem with the various provinces revolting against his government. And now put that in context, put Tatnai's actions in context, and it starts to become a little more clear. Why is this such a big deal that we're building this temple? Because they're putting down revolts across the empire. Great, now we have the Jews also. Let's just add them to the list. So I think that's an important element to be aware of. Not my find, I found that somewhere else. But that's the issue here. Now, someone asked as we were going through this, yeah, it was David who said it. Well, didn't we have that decree of Darius who had actually, not Darius, the decree of Artaxerxes that we had recorded that said stop, right? How does that figure into this? So the answer is either, and this is the Dan Mikra view, that story happens later. That story is a later story, which we just brought back here as an illustration of things Samaritans did to stop us. But actually, as of this point, there was no legal obstruction. Only the fact that the Samaritans had intimidated us kept us from building for the last 18 years. And then the prophet said, no, you know, get moving. So that would be one approach to it. The other approach to it, though, would be that that's exactly what Tatnai's point is. there's a letter saying you shouldn't be building. Where did this come from? The only problem, and we're going to have to come back to it, with that is going to be with their response. Meaning, when we get to chapter 6 and you find the response of, okay, they can build, the question is going to be, well, wait, what happened to that original letter? So when we get to chapter 6, we'll have to deal with that. That might happen today, but I wouldn't give odds. Okay, so we make it through 5, that's going to be a world record. The bottom line is, again, focus on just the basic story. Inspired by Haggai and Zechariah, the Jews have said, we are now going to build. They start the construction. Along comes Tatnai and says, show me your papers. We don't have any papers. He asks who's in charge. We tell him who's in charge. He sends a letter back to headquarters saying, what should I do? You're dealing with all these revolts. What do you want us to do about these guys? But he says, look, you want to keep on building? Gesinnte Haet, which may have been a wise move if he's really worried about revolts. Like, he doesn't want to fight. This is, maybe just a very practical move on his part of, I'm not interested in trouble, so if they want to build, they can build, and if the government decides that they don't want them building, then, they can, come tear it down, have fun.
Babylon is in Tatnai's jurisdiction.
Babylon is not. It's in his superior's jurisdiction. Yeah. We said that was his superior. He himself is just Avarnahara, just this side of the river. Why do you ask?
No, I was curious if any of the revolts that are going on are part of Tatnai's problem.
Oh, I don't think so. Tatnai is one of those guys, he's like employee of the month. Like, he's doing well. No revolts in X number of days. Okay, so let's see what happens. This is the letter, starting in Pasuk Vav, sentence 6. Parshegen igarta dishlach Tatnai pachas avarnara. Here is the text of the letter sent by Tatnai the pacha. Ushtar boznai, which apparently is one word. And shtar boznai uchnavasei, and his friends afarsechayei. Which is a term that we already used earlier. It's the reference to some sort of Persian. Some, it doesn't say Persian, but these are Persians. Diba Avarnahara, who are living on that side of the river. Al Daryavish Malka sent to King Darius. Pisgama Shalachu Aloi, they sent a letter to him. V'chidinaksiv Begavei, and the following is what's written. L'Daryavish Malka Shlomakola to King Darius. Peace to all, Malbim says, meaning this is a friendly inquiry. We're okay. Don't panic when you see a letter. Yedia, because it's an unusual beginning. Shlomo Kola is not what we've seen before in letters. Yedia lehevi lemalka, be it known to the king. Diazalna lihud midinta, we went to the land of Judea. Leves elah, that's a phrase, by the way, we've seen before, we've referred to before, calling the Jews Judea, Yehud. Leves elah karaba, to the house of the great God. V'hu misnebe Evan Galal, and it's being built of Evan Galal. Evan Galal is stone, generally rendered as marble. It comes up in the Gemara in the beginning of Bava Kamma when they're explaining the word shein as one of the forms of nezek, one of the torts. Ibn Ezra has a novel explanation for why marble would become known as galal. He says it's legalgel, to roll. The stone is very heavy, and therefore to get it from the quarry to the construction site, you have to roll it. Hence the name galal. Okay. V'ah mitzam b'chuslaya, and there is wood placed in the walls as well. V'avidita dach asparna mis'avda u'matzlach b'yed hom. And it's actually going very well. This work is being done quickly, and they are successful. Edayin she'el n'l'shavaya ilech. So at that point, when I did this site visit and I saw what's going on, I asked these former captives who had returned, Kenema Amarna Lahon. As I'm about to tell you, this is what I said. Mansam Lachom Te'im Besa Da Lemivnia. Who gave you permission? Who gave you the order to build this house? Vusharna Dinala Shachlala, and to strengthen these walls or foundations. Vashmas Hon She'elna Lahom, and I asked them their names, Lo Da'usach, to tell you, Dinichtub Shum Guvraya Diba Rashayam, to write down the names of the leaders. Uchanema Pisgama, and when told this to them, Hasivuna Lememar, they responded saying, Anachna Himo Avdoi Dialaka Shmaya Va'ara, We are the servants of the God of the heavens and the earth. And we're building the house that had already been there for many years. A great king of Israel, right, Shlomo, built it and strengthened it. Lahain, min dihargizu avahasano la'elaka shemaya, yahav himo biyad v'chaneta melech bavel kazda, uvaisa dinasasrei v'ama haglila bavel. But what happened was, our ancestors angered the God of the heavens, and he gave them into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel of the Chaldeans, and he destroyed this house, and he exiled this nation to Babel. Biram, however, Bishnas Chada L'Choresh Malka Di Babel, Choresh Malka Sam Te'im, Beis L'Laka Dina Livnei. But in the first year of Cyrus, he decreed that we could build this house. I'm actually going to pause there because otherwise we'll have too much to cover. So first of all, the description that he gives, right, from this first part of the letter. You see anything interesting in the first part of the letter? The part where he describes what's happening?
Why are these things so explicit? What they want is the permission that Harry has originally issued, right? They want a copy of a document.
Yeah.
Please send me the deed to my house to prove that it's mine.
Right, he goes into detail. Not just that. I mean, there's so... Well, the detail that he quotes here about us going into exile is us. Yeah. That was our response, which he's faithfully recording. But even before that, in his own words, like, oh, and they're building it out of marble, and there's wood in the marble.
And they're doing very well.
And they're building it rapidly, which...
It's a very
positive
description.
Yeah, I'm not sure they read the Jews were.
Right, I'm not sure the Jews would have viewed it as being rapid. He says it's rapid, but David says, you know, this is a positive description. In what sense is it positive? What gives the impression this is positive?
It's successful.
But it's successful.
Yeah.
Helen, Devi, and then Ari.
Interesting that he's referring to the temple of the great God is what my translation
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
And he's acknowledging.
Maybe.
The great God is great.
Right. Or this is, you know, what they call the great God would be the other answer. But yeah, no, I'm
great.
Right. It's true. Go think back to what Cyrus did also, right? You know, Elaka Shmaya, God of the heavens. Ari and then Shana.
Well, another angle I was looking at, so they're building something massive, something serious. They're not just piling up some rocks and temporary.
Plays up the size of it. Could be. Shana.
It's not. It's along the lines of Shlomo Lapol. It's like everything's fine, and he's not giving any alarms. He's not suggesting there's anything subversive. It's
right.
Just a building project.
Right. So you can look at it in a lot of ways, Laurie.
I was just thinking here. He just happened to be visiting, you know, part of this tour of his province or whatever he's in charge of, I have to come, and this is what I found.
Yeah.
Now, let's establish what's going on.
Right. He doesn't say why he went there. It goes back a little bit to David's question of, was this sparked by Samaritans? And we don't know, but he doesn't say anything about any Samaritans. He just says, look, this was a visit, and here's what I found. So there really are two ways you can read this. One way you can read this is to suggest he's playing up the size of the thing, he's playing up the wealth involved, he's playing up the speed as a way to say, this is a threat, you better do something. That's one, that's if you don't like him. On the other hand, Malbim says, that's not the way to read it at all. Take a look at source number 8. He says just the opposite. Tanai is helping us. Hine bazed darshu tovasam. With this they start to benefit. Shodiu sheinam bonim mivtzar misgav. Saying, we're not building a mighty fortress. Ki misimim eitz baktalim. We're putting wood in the walls. Shebekal yisareif ba'esh ve'enolim misgav. That gets burned easily. It's not a good fortress. Right? In my Shoftim Shir on Thursday, we just learned the story of Abimelech burning down fortresses. or causing smoke inhalation. It's not entirely clear. But either way, this is, you know, this isn't what you do if you're rebelling. You don't put wood in the walls. And in fact, the Gemara is going to note what he puts here in brackets, which is that in Perek Vav, when we get Cyrus's order to build, Cyrus says, Shemitam Zetzivar Koresh, Sheyivnu Kol Shu HaRaviyas Shal Eitz. Cyrus, in fact, instructs that every fourth layer within the walls be wood so that it can burn. That's the point. The Talmud picks up on this. We'll have to discuss it when we get to chapter 6. Umalachas oznaseis mehera, umatzlachas bidem, and as far as the fact that it's going quickly and being successful, gambazehim litzulei morshamim asher svivosam ein mashbisim hamalacha. That shows that the nations around them are not halting them. Kiim bashum chash mered o davara o mazik lemelech o lahamim. There's no harm to anybody. There's no threat to anybody. This is all good. Now, I wrote in brackets when I first did the translation here that the Jews are lobbying, but this is actually, based on my read of the sentence, I don't think that's correct. I think it's Tatnai who is doing the lobbying, meaning this isn't the part that is our words yet. Our words start after this. I believe this is actually Tatnai, and he's, you know, again, I'm convinced by Malbim that what he's saying is positive, although you could legitimately read it the other way and say that he's saying this is a real threat. Look at what they're doing. They have marble, they're going fast, and so on. Yeah.
Perhaps that's excellent diplomacy, deliberate ambiguity.
It will be entirely consistent with Malbim's point about Shimshai and Rechum, right, that we saw last week, where they write a letter which can be interpreted in two different ways, in order to protect themselves even as they pursue an agenda. So it's, yes, is it possible that he's deliberately ambiguous? Yeah, entirely possible. I mean, this is a diplomat in the Persian Empire. You know, you don't get to be Pecha without knowing what you're doing. Yeah.
But just what we're about to read next is saying something very positive, because he's saying, you know what, King Cyrus went and gave them everything to put in the temple. You know, that's...
Well, that's not him. That's us.
What the Jews are saying, but he's
right,
passing on that information.
Yes.
That it is in a positive way that they're doing this. It's not a threatening thing.
Right.
Doing it all.
Right. I mean, he certainly is careful about doing his job. At the very least, even if he doesn't like us, yeah, and especially if you're going to take the video, he doesn't like us, he records things and he passes it along in a way that ends up being in our favor.
But he could very easily have reported that we're building it without saying these, what I would call, positive aspects of it.
For sure.
Yeah, but then they would check.
He goes to this extra effort.
But then they would check in the records and say, what's this guy bothering them? They got permission from Cyrus, finish him off.
But all he's saying is, I've seen this. What do I do? He follows up, says, what do I do?
Yeah. I'm not sure. It's a very interesting thing. And like I said, I think this matters, how we view Tatnai. I don't think it's a trivial thing.
In the second year of Darius, who is prime minister?
The second year of Darius, who is prime minister? What? You mean second in command for Ahasuerus? Is Mordechai in command at this point, you're asking?
What I'm saying is, after the king of the Esther story has died,
right,
it's followed by, we'd like to say, Esther's son.
Right.
And who is not Mordechai's son? Prime minister?
By the time, assuming that Darius is the son of Esther and Ahasuerosh, right, taking that view of the chronology, you have to allow for enough time for Darius to actually take the throne, right, Ahasuerosh to be gone, in order for this to work. And then ask yourself, who is Darius going to appoint when presuming Mordechai is gone as well? Meaning, I don't have the slightest clue at this point who would have succeeded Mordechai.
I'm being careful, because Jews still have a big say in the court.
It's an interesting idea. I have no idea. I don't know. All right, so we've established then is the Jews were building, they were doing what they were supposed to do, Tatnai came along, whether spurred by our enemies or not, we don't know. gives us a hard time, whether because he's doing his job or whether because he doesn't like us, finds out from us what our story is and who is in charge, and sends a letter back to the government, of which we've only read part. We read his part, piece of it. And his language could be read as being trying to start trouble for us, or, as Malcolm reads it, trying to help us out by presenting it in the best light possible. And you could see it really either way. So next time, God willing, we'll finish off this chapter with what the Jews replied and move into the evidence in the Persian archives. Thank you.